It's an exciting weekend, a big weekend, with the Harrisburg Symphony, this weekend's concert. Masterwork series.
It's the sixth Masterworks of the season, and what a masterwork. One piece. Very long piece.
Yeah, you sort of look at a program and think, geez, there's only one piece on the program, but this is a 90-minute piece. It's a single symphony.
It is an enormously large symphony. It might be the longest symphony in the repertoire. It'll run about an hour and 40 minutes, and but what an hour and 40 minutes. It's a lifetime worth of music in one evening. It's one of these typical Mahler amazing journey type pieces.
And it's also a piece that is always an event whenever it's performed, because obviously as long as it is, as big as the orchestra is for this and everything that goes into it, you don't hear it very often. So I'm hoping that there are people coming up from, like Philadelphia, Baltimore, who might want to hear a Mahler Third live.
I hope that's the case. I certainly think it will be worth the trip.
Yeah.
It is a piece that's it's a big undertaking on many, many levels, but particularly just the size of the orchestra makes it forbidding for most orchestras to perform it.
I know it's a very difficult piece technically to conduct because of all the details, and of course Mahler was a great conductor, so he knew what he was doing.
Yep.
So you assume there are ways of doing it, but it's also very difficult to put together, I guess. I mean, you've got a 90 or, over an hour and a half long symphony. The first movement is a little over a half hour. The last movement is almost a half hour, and it's the slow movement. How do you conceive of putting something like that together?
Well, the first thing that I think needs to be said is that when you do a piece like this, because of how complicated it is and how much is going on at any given moment, the job of the conductor is kind of macrocosmic. You simply can't get absorbed at any given moment in details because there are so many details going on.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know what's happening. You need to have a conception of what you want from those details. But in the moment, you're not actually conducting the details because everyone has different details. So in essence, you can't perform a piece like this unless you have an orchestra that you completely trust,
mm-hmm.
That they're going to, first of all, learn the piece as well as just their part, know how it fits together, and do the individual work that's necessary to get something like this off the ground. With that, I mean, it's just like studying any other piece, just on a much larger scale. You need to come up with an idea of how it's going to move, the general sweep of the piece. The first movement is very, very intense, and Mahler calls it the first part of the piece, and then follows a few shorter, but extremely extensive.
And quote, lighter.
Yeah, and lighter, but yeah. Still very involved movements. And I think that oftentimes the mistake is made to overemphasize the importance of the outside movements, mm-hmm. and not pay enough attention to the inner movements, which are part of the heart and soul of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
There are specific difficulties in conducting the piece, certainly not a walk in the park for a conductor, but by the same token, it's an exciting piece for a conductor to do. It's one of these conductor dream pieces, because there's such a wave of sound that comes at you, so much to work with, and such incredible, intensely beautiful music.
And I know a lot of the musicians are going to be looking forward to the opportunity to play it, because they don't get a chance to play it very often, and there are some huge solos. I think this is like every trombonist's dream.
Yeah, I don't know that Brent Phillips, our principal trombonist, has ever performed the piece. I know that he's learned it, because mm-hmm. they all do.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Snedeker, our principal trumpet, can't wait to get his hands around the post-horn solo in the third movement. And there are other solo parts that people might not think of, like the bass drum.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the ultimate virtuoso bass drum parts in the repertoire, and I know that Chris Rose is going to eat it up and do a great job.
It's not the thing you normally think of, virtuosic bass drum parts.
But
it's a very important part.
It is a crucial part, and it's a palpable part.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in the loud sections, but as an individual voice, particularly in that first movement, it really sets the tone of the entire piece.
Right. And how big an orchestra are we talking here? I mean, Mahler was always into this whole gigantic thing.
Yep. I'm not terribly good at remembering specifics, but I know that it's over 100 players
mm-hmm.
on stage, as well as a chorus of a women's chorus and a children's chorus. It's a big piece. Most standard romantic symphonies will have what we call triple winds, meaning three flutes or two flutes and a piccolo, three oboes or two oboes and an English horn, three clarinets, three bassoons. This one goes, you know, a step further in the woodwinds with four flutes, two flutes, and often two piccolos, four oboes, five clarinets, including two E-flat clarinets and a bass clarinet, four bassoons, including a contrabassoon, four trombones rather than the normal three, four trumpets, eight horns plus an assistant, two full sets of timpani, two harps. So it's just everything on a much, much larger scale.
I know with, the Symphony of the Thousand is one that we usually think of as the biggest one.
Yeah.
Actually, that had over 1,000 people at its premiere performance. It was a marketing thing that the manager had come up with to sell it.
It calls for it. The orchestra itself is no bigger than this orchestra.
Yeah.
But that has multiple choruses and soloists, and right. Yes, it certainly could easily become that large.
I think it was 170 instrumentalists, you know, when you consider all of the string players and everything to balance.
It's
because if
nutty,
you have five winds, you need more violins to sort of balance.
So everyone is going to have to work very, very hard, and we'll have to grapple again with the complications of playing at the Forum, both in terms of acoustic and also in terms of space on stage.
Just fitting, yeah.
Because it's a wide and not terribly deep stage. So part of what I've been doing today is sketching out pictures of what the orchestra could look like where people can be sitting. So it should be fun. I'm excited.
I know there's a big deal about Mahler and his original program because he came up with...
What the birds tell me, what nature tells me.
And all of this. And then, of course, by the time 6 years later it was premiered, he didn't want any of that. So... First of all, I guess, is this going into the program so that the audience knows what the
It certainly
the
won't be on
called?
The program page because that's just not appropriate. It's not what Mahler intended. I do think that it will be in the program notes because any real program notes for this piece would have to include such information. Just for the sake of this podcast, he called the first movement a move into summer, led by Pan's March. And then he had what the flowers tell me, what the animals tell me, what man tells me, what the angels tell me, and finally, I guess, what God tells me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about love. I don't think that it's something that's worth neglecting.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that it's important information approaching this piece because it is the initial inspirational spark that got Mahler going, and you could hear it reflected in the music, and it gives you hints as to how you might perform the music. But the piece works perfectly well without any program at all. It's just... drama shifting in different ways, and I like calling this piece a cinematic piece. It feels like you're in one of these epic movies, which takes you on an emotional journey, and you have a scene that's a love scene, and you have a scene that's out in the countryside, and you have a first scene which is very dramatic and just sets the stage for the real action of the piece, and then finally a serene ending where I guess the lovers walk off into the sunset to great grandeur.
It's a powerful ending, too. I mean,
it is.
It's a slow movement, so we normally think, there's not going to be that much going on. But, I mean, it's a very, first of all, loud, but secondly, positive. I mean, it's a happy ending without being fast.
It is. And the final movement, you can draw comparisons with the Ninth Symphony, which we did a few years ago, which also ends with a big adagio, slow final movement. But in that piece, it's really a farewell to life, a very sad resignation from life. This piece is an embrace of life and of love, and the melodies are so luscious and the harmony so rich, and the orchestration, which starts out in an absolute hush. He marks a triple piano for the strings for the first 3-4 minutes of this movement is in hushed tones playing this very simple, beautiful, intimate melody, and then it develops. At each time the melody comes back, it's more intense, more emotional, and finally it ends with a statement that begins with a hushed brass chorale, and soon the whole orchestra is playing this in fortissimo, and the timpani is playing boom, 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 kind of sound. And it is. I think it's one of the most inspiring and uplifting final movements in the entire repertoire, despite its slow speed.
Mm-hmm.
And I also will say that I'm not one for taking this adagio at a ridiculously slow tempo. If I had to find fault with some recordings. It's just that if you take the movement too slow, you actually lose the melody, mm-hmm. and it just becomes a beautiful chord followed by a beautiful chord, and line is everything in this piece. So I wouldn't look for this final movement to be, you know, time stands still, but rather an emotional ending to a grand piece.
That's interesting, because I often think of Mahler as like a series of lines, because he writes all this fairly dense counterpoint.
He does all the time, and an instrument, you'll have a main line sometimes, and other instruments will bring in other lines, not even in the same place. So he'll mm-hmm. add. He was a brilliant contrapuntalist. Maybe not. You can't say that it's as perfect as Bach, because mm-hmm. sometimes it's jarring.
But he also wasn't writing fugues.
Exactly.
It was just the idea of independent lines moving at
independent
times.
That's right. And he's looking for an effect. This is music that's designed to affect the audience, and it's not always affecting the audience into tears or affecting the audience into great joy. It's sometimes affecting the audience into being a little bit disturbed, mm-hmm. being irked. You know, there are places in the third movement where it's very pointed, mm-hmm. and I think it should feel almost like a pinprick in this beautiful pastoral setting.
I think Mahler even said of that movement, I don't know if it was before the premiere or not, but he said it's like nature is making faces at you, sticking out its tongue.
That's right.
And then the post-horn solo comes along, and that's actually mankind,
yep.
which nature realizes is something it's going to have to deal with.
And it's an embrace of mankind. Mm-hmm. And then then it goes back into the wild, and mankind is
polka,
left behind.
Isn't it?
Well, it's kind of like a polka, yeah. It's very strange and goofy almost.
Yeah.
It feels like a folk dance, and feels, you know, almost a little bit like the quasi-Jewish music from the slow movement of the First mm-hmm. Symphony. So I can't get into Mahler's mind. He's not around to tell us anymore, and he did eliminate the What the Animals Tell Me title. But you definitely hear animal sounds. I mean, you hear cuckoos, and you hear growls, and you hear braying, and it's an amazing
definitely
composition.
In there. It was, I look at it as the, you know, something that a composer uses, I don't know, we call it a crutch, but something to build on,
mm-hmm.
and then you can take that away once you've got everything over it, and it doesn't matter to the audience whether it is or not.
Absolutely, and when I first did this piece several years ago, this is my second go at it. It was down in Greensboro, and the third movement was the one that I had the most trouble getting my arms around to feel like this is a great movement.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that it was the weakest, but I think that I've come around, and I think it's one of the best parts of the piece, and mm. just because it's so different from everything else. I mean, the first movement is spectacular and dramatic and almost grotesque in its marching band sound a lot of the time. The second movement is lyrical and some of the best Viennese writing you'll ever hear. Typical Mahler, spectacularly beautiful. Then you have the third movement, which is a little goofy, but I think for where it is in the piece, it fits so absolutely beautifully mm-hmm. and sets the stage so beautifully for the somberness of the next movement, where the mezzo-soprano sings Nietzsche. And you couldn't have that movement without the brusqueness of the third movement.
Well, there's all the contrast around it, because you've got the nature stuff before that, and then
yep.
right after it, it's like in rush the little angels,
absolutely.
You know, the bells and everything,
yep.
which is a fascinating contrast.
Yeah.
So, and then of course the last movement. I know there were a lot of people asking Mahler, well, what do you mean? The last movement is What Love Tells Me. And, you know, well, what kind of love? You know,
yep.
he's talking about spiritual love,
yep.
the love of God, what
it is
God
the love
tells
of God.
Him.
And it's not in the sense of Christian love, it's more just a sense of this powerful God embracing humanity,
mm-hmm.
and you feel it, and at times it almost has a human passion to it. It's not in any way sterile or antiseptic. It's a very warm, deep, passionate love.
Mm-hmm. There's an interesting ladder to the whole piece, because it begins with this almost incantation, and then the feel of like life being created out of,
yeah, there's
this
definitely a primordial sense to this first movement,
and I love all the trombone glissandos, the growls and
yeah,
things like
it's
this,
fantastic.
You know, like some dragon,
yeah.
you know, whatever. But you know, you get through all this, you get this march, which actually Mahler wanted to be, you know, sounding vulgar, and he found this kind of shocking then when he heard it in contrast with with everything else, and then the flowers in the next movement. But you have this ladder of going from the primordial things to the flowers, to the animals, to mankind, yep. You know, to angels,
and then to
God, to love, you know, and everything like yep. that. So it's a fascinating development when you think about it. Mahler didn't think of it as a symphony when he started it. But a year or two later, he's saying, it's like, well, it's very similar to what Haydn and Beethoven were doing. It's just that they're not in the same order.
Absolutely.
And he's not using the form the same way because he's expanding it and all this stuff. But it's not difficult for the listener to follow if the listener cares to listen.
Oh, not at all. And you can draw very appropriate analogies to the Pastoral Symphony of Beethoven, mm-hmm. which also was more than four movements, which is mm-hmm. at the time was not at all a standard, had a program about nature and about humanity's interaction with nature, and about animals and joy and thanksgiving to God. I don't know whether that was in Mahler's mind, but there's certainly there's a little bit of a dose of that in
this
piece.
Well, there's a thunderstorm and all that sort of stuff, you know, near the end of the first
movement. Well, and the other thing that I find fascinating is in the mezzo movement with the text from Also Sprach Zarathustra, it has that major minor mm-hmm. contrast that also Strauss used in Also Sprach mm-hmm. Zarathustra at the very beginning. And, you know, it works absolutely beautifully in both cases, but I don't know whether this was a subconscious idea, but it just was very interesting that they both chose to do that.
I know, well, Nietzsche was somebody that a German could hardly avoid.
I mean, of course, he was standard sort of, you know, mainstream standard culture.
Yeah. And I know that Mahler and Strauss were sort of on the same wavelength at this time, because they both started, I think Death and Transfiguration is contemporary with Mahler's first
That's
symphony
right.
or something like
so
that.
So this would have been very, very close in time to Also Sprach.
And so, you know, Strauss's whole programmatic idea, I mean, he called them tone poems, he didn't write symphonies, but Mahler was writing symphonies in which he was giving these elaborate programs, sometimes to explain what he was thinking when he was writing it, and other times just to try and explain the music to somebody who had no idea what was going on. But then by the time he premiered this, he and Strauss had split their ways, and Mahler said, you know, down with programs. I don't want this to be involved in any of it. And yet
his music is so obviously thematic. I mm-hmm. mean, thematic in terms of his life or, mm-hmm. or his ideas. Whether there's a program or not, in print, there's a program
in his mind,
in the mind, and in the music, and so that's what keeps the audience intrigued. And a piece this long, it's an incredible feat that he doesn't lose the audience at any point. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have any parts of the symphony where it just kind of drifts or wanders. It's a very focused piece of music. At every moment, there's some kind of intensity that an audience can grasp onto and pulls them through, even in very long last movement.
I know that when, you know, Mahler was conducting this piece at the premiere, which was, I think, 6 years after he finished writing it, for various reasons, that it took that long, but the audience response was so incredibly positive, mm-hmm. Something he wasn't used to. The world premiere of the Third Symphony is basically what made his career, because while he was respected as a conductor, they didn't take his compositions that seriously.
Which is amazing, given how incredible the First and Second Symphonies are.
Right. But there was always some kind of, you know, I have no idea what you're doing up there, you know. And yet with this one, there was an immediate response that was, I mean, it was almost, you know, Mahler was treated like a hero for having created a piece so intense.
And I look at this piece in the same way that I look at the Ninth Symphony of Mahler. These are pieces that are as experiential as music comes. Mm-hmm. And they're music that you have to hear this piece live in a concert hall to experience it. And you need to experience this piece sometime in your life, because mm-hmm. it's that kind of music. In the same way that, you know, people say everyone has to see Casablanca at some point, mm-hmm. because it's that kind of a work of art. This is that kind of work of art. You just need to experience it sometime.
And I know that, I mean, I heard this, I don't know, I was in my 20s, I guess, when I heard a recording of it. This is actually the first time I will hear a live performance of it. And I know I'm looking forward to it for that reason, because I know
exciting.
That live performances are much different than hearing something that's canned from a studio out of loudspeakers.
And luckily, our orchestra has the ability to play it well. Mm-hmm. You know, you wouldn't want to hear this piece played poorly. It's not the right piece for that. There are pieces that can sustain themselves either because they're not all that difficult or because they're written thickly enough, but this is a piece that it's a virtuoso piece where the beauty of the piece only really comes out in a virtuoso performance.
Right. You talked about the orchestra because you've worked with the orchestra a lot. The choir that is involved in this, actually, it's almost...
It's the Messiah College Women's Choir. Mm-hmm. And the last time I did this, it was a mix of voices between adult women and younger women. And this time I decided to go with just younger women as an artistic choice because mm-hmm. it will have the youth that I envision the angels having.
Right.
And so we'll have these, not children's voices, but young women's voices, college-aged women's voices, singing the women's chorus. And then we have the Susquehanna Chorale Youth Chorale, mm-hmm. Which sang as part of La Boheme a few months ago, mm-hmm. And they'll be singing the they're the bells. the heavenly bells, yeah. and they really do a fantastic job. So I'm working with them just this afternoon for the mm-hmm. first time. So I'm excited to hear the work that they've done. It's a short movement, but again, it's a crucial movement, mm-hmm. Not just in terms of the text, in terms of all of that, but rather in terms of the dramatic sweep of the piece.
And the contrast.
It really does. It serves as a beautiful foil both to what comes before with the dark Nietzsche movement and what comes after with the very human, down-to-earth, passionate movement. This is music that truly is written as music of the spheres. Mm-hmm. He uses no violins, so you have none of that middle warmth. He just uses low strings, woodwinds, and a little bit of brass. And it creates this kind of light texture. And then, of course, you have real bells with the human bells mm-hmm. And this chorus of angels. So I'm thinking that will come off quite beautifully, too.
And the mezzo-soprano who is singing the Nietzsche movement.
Elena Chinakis. She mm-hmm. comes to us from San Jose, California. Mm. And she's a wonderful singer. And
have you worked with her before?
I have not worked with her before. We found her... we get submissions from agents of singers, and oftentimes they either send recordings or you can get recordings on the internet. And we looked at many, many singers for this particular role, and I think her voice suits it quite beautifully. So I'm excited to work with her for the first time.
Well, that'll be good, too. All right, so we've got an intensely grand symphony.
Yes, indeed.
A very long work, so be prepared for that as you come in to listen to the concert.
Yep. Hit the restroom before you enter.
And then, you know, by the time everything's over, I think everybody will feel a little bit transformed with all of this. It's amazing.
That's what I'm thinking, too. It is not in any way a difficult work. Mm-hmm. It is not a work that requires a struggle from the audience. The Ninth Symphony does. Mm-hmm. The Ninth Symphony is created in a way that is often imponderable, still riveting and fantastic. But this is a piece that really is a young Mahler, mm-hmm. Still at the height of his creative abilities, but with this youthful energy and beauty, and it's kind of a paean to nature, man, and God. Mm-hmm. And I think that the audience will relate in a very deep way to the piece, whether it's a spiritual way or just a human enjoyment way. This is, when I heard this piece for the first time was in New York when Bernstein did his last set of Mahler concerts at Carnegie Hall, and it was simply an unforgettable, transformational experience. Hearing this piece, this is a piece that has the potential to change you in a certain way. Whether it's for a moment and you leave the hall feeling exultant, or whether it actually lives with you after that, I do think it's a piece that the audience is going to absolutely adore hearing.
Mm-hmm. That's Saturday, the 16th of April. Concert is at 8 o'clock. Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, all at the Forum in downtown Harrisburg. Come an hour early. I'll be doing a pre-concert talk. Getting into some of the program and some of the background of the symphony and how it works in Mahler's overall symphonic works. So come and enjoy. And, sir, thanks for sitting down and talking. I know you have a lot of work to do.
I sure do.
And
thank you, Dick, very much for the time again.
Great. Thank you.